You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 2, 2015, Ron Coddington presented the second lecture in our six-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses for 2015. Listen as Mr. Coddington tells the story of how both the North and South developed their Navy during the American Civil War. While other kids in his neighborhood were collecting baseball cards, 14-year-old Ron Coddington was browsing flea markets looking for old photographs. Little did he realize that after purchasing his first photograph in 1977, that collecting photographic images would become a lifelong pursuit. Mr. Coddington is the assistant manager at Chronicle of Higher Education, whose work has appeared in USA Today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the San Jose Mercury News. Mr. Coddington is a contributing writer to the New York Times Disunion series and writes a monthly column for the Civil War News. In addition to African American Faces of the Civil War, an album, Mr. Coddington has written two other books, Faces of Confederacy, an album of Southern soldiers and their stories, and Faces of the Civil War, an album of Union soldiers and their stories. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Civil War Sailors, A Photo Potpourri. Here's Ron Coddington.
Well, hello, everyone. There's two things that I have never done before speaking tonight. This is my first one. I've never been late, ever. So this is the first time, and I apologize. Second one, this is a work in progress. I'm going to talk to you tonight about sailors in the Civil War navies, both the Union and the Confederate. I usually talk about my books when they're done. This one is about halfway through. I should be working on it tonight, but I am not. I am here, so thank you for giving me a reason to... to get away. So I want to start tonight by giving you some numbers just to give you a sense of what the navies were like. This is the number of sailors in the Confederate Navy in 1861. Next.
It's a nice round number.
At the height, and the record keeping wasn't the best here. But the most reliable number that I've found is in 1864, 5,214. That's enlisted men, that's officers, and that's Marines. Next. Now, our friends in the North, they did have a Navy. It was small, but it's bigger than zero. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the next slide, by the end, 61,966. Next. If you add up the total enlistments in the Union Navy during those 4 years, you have about 118,000 altogether. So let's compare that to the overall enlistments for the military. Big number. So the Navy is tiny throughout the war, very, very small. Next. Now let's take a look at the ships. We'll start with the South. I was impressed they broke 100. That's the best number. That's the highest number that I can find. Next, please. In the North, next. They had 90, almost as many as the Confederacy had at their highest point. They started with 90 and 671 by 1865. It's a lot, kind of. Let's take a look at one of those vessels. Next. This is the Harriet Lane, one of the most popular vessels at the time of the Civil War. It was not a Navy vessel. It was part of the Revenue Service, which is sort of an early Coast Guard. The Harriet Lane is named for this lovely lady, and she was, next, the niece of this not-so-attractive-looking man, James Buchanan, our 15th president. Next. The guy who was captain of the Harriet Lane from the very beginning, which was in 1857, is this man, and his name is John Faunce. And I want you to meet him tonight and introduce him to you, because he's an interesting guy. And he's one of the many folks that I've profiled in working on the book so far. So he was a captain in the U.S. Revenue Marine Service. Next. You may know this man, Winfield Scott, old fuss and feathers. He and John Faunce are part of a rumor mill that's going on in 1860, early 1861, after South Carolina secedes, when the North is wondering, what are we possibly going to do? Next, please. Scott is credited with coming up with this plan, which a lot of folks refer to as the Anaconda Plan. The idea here was, and you can see this nice pictorial map, was to surround the borders, the boundaries, the water boundaries of the Confederacy. There's probably another little snake that you could put up the Mississippi to bisect it, but that was Scott's overall plan. Not the most original plan. A lot of folks had thought about it, but imagine trying to blockade this many miles of coastline with 100 ships or 90 ships in 1861. Almost impossible. Next. Here's Winfield Scott. You notice the cartoonist has trimmed him down a little bit. He's looking pretty good. So a lot of people are saying, man, we should go ahead and send Winfield Scott down there in the Harriet Lane with 200 Marines, and we'll end this thing right now. And John Faunce and Winfield Scott, there are a lot of talk about these two guys in the news, a lot of rumors in Washington. Next. So, there's a quote here talking about why this rumor was started. And according to a story in the New York Times, it says, "The moral effect of her presence," that's the Harriet Lane, "at the mouth of Charleston Harbor, however it is believed, would be very salutary in restraining any imprudent action on the part of the seceders. One thing is certain. Captain Faunce has never been found wanting in any position where he has been placed, and he may be firmly relied on to sustain the good name of the government under whose flag he has so long enlisted. The present armament of the Harriet Lane consists of four 24-pound howitzers, a swivel gun, and a bunch of other metal and armor and guns. All of them are formidable in resisting attack." Next. This rumor, of course, is just a rumor. It doesn't come true, and it's one of many. But around the time of the bombardment of Fort Sumter, Faunce is sent down there in the Harriet Lane and his trusty crew. Next. This quote is part of a reminiscence of Gustavus Vassa Fox, who is soon to become Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Navy. They're right up close to the fort. They can see all the action happening, but they're not firing. They neared the land. They heard this, saw the smoke. They heard the shells. Everything was visible to them. Next. "While the bombardment raged," and I'm reading a quote here, "and gun and smoke mixed with low-lying banks of mist, a steamer appeared with no ensign flying." That's this ship here. "At 11:20 a.m., Faunce and the crew of the Lane went into action. They signaled the vessel to show their colors and come to. The ship did not respond. Faunce ordered a warning shot fired. Daniel T. Tompkins, the second lieutenant in charge of the bow gun, obeyed his captain's command. According to the same Revenue Service historian, he says, a 32-pound shot ricocheted across the bows of the strange steamer, a grim and significant warning to heave to and render an account of herself. The American ensign was at once displayed from her main peak. In fact, the ship, this ship here, was the merchant steamer Nashville, and Fonts let it pass after it flew the American ensign. This, many historians will tell you, was the first naval shot fired in the Civil War, and it was fired under Fonts's order. So, that's a little bit about Mr. Fonts. Next. His quote, "He is not a man of many words," simply said, "It had the desired effect." Next, please. The Harriet Lane and Fonts soon part because the Navy, needing more ships, basically says, "We'll take the Harriet Lane and you can stay Captain Fonts in the Revenue Service." So Fonts continues doing his thing with the Revenue Service, and the Harriet Lane is drafted into the Navy. Later on in the war, and this is the Harriet Lane, the mysterious boat next to it is a Confederate steamer that just captured it. This was in Galveston, Texas. The ship was captured. A number of the crew were killed when the ship was boarded. And it wound up coming back into American hands at the end of the war. It was left, I think, in Bermuda, where it became more or less a hulk. There was a fire that damaged it, and there really wasn't much the Navy could do with it. So around 1866 or 1867, the ship is still sitting in a dock somewhere out in the middle of the ocean and not much going on. Next. Fonts is called back, and they say, "Captain Fonts, why don't you go get the Harriet Lane and bring her home?" So the two, the man and his ship, are reunited. He goes out there, he fixes the ship up so it can be at least movable, brings it back to the United States, and the two have their reunion, but the ship is later determined to be too badly damaged and not of use. So they part their ways again. So this is one of the stories in the book. Next, please. And speaking of books, there's my first book. They're all based, all the books I've done since then, which this will be my fourth, are all based on the same idea. Next. And that is that I think there's really something when you look into the eyes of a soldier or a sailor, get a sense of what they wore, how they wore it, a sense of their presence, the realization that these images of these soldiers are part of our story. They're part of America's story. They were never really intended to be. They were part of personal collections and photo albums and what have you. But now they are becoming more and more a part of collectors. They've now made their ways into libraries, the Library of Congress, and other museums. They are a part of our visual history. And to see their photograph, which in some cases is the only known photograph of one of these individuals, and then read their story is really powerful. Next. These photographs would not be possible without this man, Daguerre, who was a Frenchman. And as you can see by the caption, he invented the process of commercial photography, building on the work of a number of other inventors, chemists, artists in 1839. And people went crazy for it. As you can imagine, there was no photographs before this. He invented it. And to have your likeness on a plate was an amazing, shocking thing. Next. So I think it can be fairly said that the Civil War generation is also the photography generation. When you think about when these individuals were born that participated in the Civil War, they came up right around the time that photography was gaining steam. Next. So we can take a look at some of the ages. Abraham Lincoln was 30. when photography was discovered. Clara Barton was 18. Your average Civil War soldier on the right was 4. Frederick Douglass was 21. U.S. Grant was 17. And George Custer was a baby. And some would say that he still was later on. Next, please. So here is a quick history. Photography, as I mentioned, is invented in France. Americans, as we do so often, we make it our own. We're technologists. We've always been. We're always looking for ways to make it better, faster, and cheaper. And here you can see, if you look at these four types of photographs, beginning in the upper left with the daguerreotype, which costs about $2.50, you can see this is very expensive. A copper plate meshed with a silver plate, very expensive chemicals that involved gold. There's a good reason that it costs $2.50. America, and also there's work continuing in Europe, begins to refine the process. And by about 1855, they replace this copper and silver plate with glass. The images get less expensive. They put varnish on top to do a better job as a preservative. And they put black paper. Sometimes they use ruby glass to make the negative image into a positive. So they've really cheapened the price by less than half by 1855. Also in 1855, they make it even cheaper when the tintype is discovered. They replace the glass plate, which the glass is kind of expensive back then compared to a simple plate of iron. And they cheapen the chemicals even more, and now they've reduced it to 50 cents. By 1860, right on the verge of the Civil War, is another invention, the carte de visite photograph. And the carte de visite is amazing because it does two things. It brings down the price dramatically. Now you can see it's down to 15 cents a photo. But what it also does is, for the first time, it makes it so that you can make multiple prints from one negative. Nowadays, we're like, oh, so what? But back then, huge. So here we are in 1860. And I know you're dying to know. Tell me more about the carte de visite. Next. Aren't you? Hey, surprise. They're about the size of a modern baseball card, which maybe is how I got started, because I loved collecting baseball cards before cartes de visite. So roughly the size of a baseball card, and here is a picture of Desdary. He's the guy who invented the carte de visite. And when I mean invented, he invented the process and became an amazingly wealthy man. He's scratching his head here, probably thinking, how can I possibly spend the millions of francs that I am making? Next, please. So, Facebook. Cartes de visite. What are you going to do with all these things? You have hundreds of them stacking up in your parlor. Queen Victoria was said to have thousands of them, of all of her family. So they invented photo albums to put all the photos inside. Again, today, not a shock, but back then, revolutionary. Next, please. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is an American man of letters, he did just about everything, poetry, a writer, and law. His writings today are rather dense. But he did say this: card portraits, as everybody knows, and card portraits were the Americanized version of carte de visite. Card portraits, as everybody knows, have become the social currency, the sentimental greenbacks of civilization. There were many, many, many made. And Wendell Holmes, in his 1864 published essay, celebrated these amazing little photos. Next. So you may be wondering, just how many were there? If you think about it and you figure, well, maybe each soldier or a good portion of soldiers posed for a photograph before they went off to war in 1861, and then some of the soldiers posed partway through for a second photo, which was common. And then some of the survivors posed for a last photograph in 1865. I figure about 40 million photos were taken. Next. If only 10% survived, that's 4 million that exist today. Next.
How big is your collection?
3.5 million. I almost have the whole series. A holdover from my baseball card days. Does anybody use eBay? I am really impressed. I have a problem. A lot of the photographs turn up on eBay. Each year, if you look for Civil War CDV, on average, you'll see 18,250 come up for auction. That's a lot. A lot of them are identified, by the way. Because one of the other unique things about this kind of photograph is on the back, because it was on paper, you could put your name and you could put your regiment. So a lot of the known photographs, a lot of the identified photographs of soldiers today are in the Cartes Z format. Next. So now that you have a little bit of background on photos, I want to tell you some stories and read you some quotes from some of the men whose photographs I discovered over the last couple of years. Next. Start with Yankee Ned. His name was Edward Clark. He later on called himself Yankee Ned when he wrote his book, 7 Years a Sailor. He was at along the coast of North Carolina in 1862, was involved in the capture of Fort Macon, and he said a lot of things in his book. This is one example, gives you a sense of how close in proximity they were, because you oftentimes think this was long-range naval warfare. Ned says, "We were so near that we could plainly see the rebels as they jumped up and loaded their guns. The wind was at the westward, cold and strong. We opened fire on the fort, and the loaders and spongers stripped to the waist and worked like men." He was a boy at the time. "We soon found that our guns threw their shells beyond the fort into the marsh, the town of Beaufort. We therefore took the precaution to obtain an exact range with a 5-second shell, and soon had a terrible fire pouring into the fort." Yankee Ned survived, wrote his book, and then he gave up the Navy altogether. At the end of his book, he says, "I had a good time, I survived," and then he became a traveling salesman and lived out the rest of his life. I don't know if he sold his book, but he had these photographs made so that he could give them out. Next, Rick. Surgeon Edward Sylvester Matthews was part of a crew, one of the many crews that were captured by the Alabama. Raphael Semmes is a name you may know. He was the commander of that ship. Captured a lot of Yankee ships, including Surgeon Matthews. The ship sank. A lot of men were injured. They were taken on board the Alabama. And Matthews approached Semmes and said, "Hey, we need to care for these guys." But before they did that, there's this quote about Semmes and about the capture. It says, "Semmes minutely superintended everything in connection with the movements of the prisoners himself, and our gallant officers and soldiers found themselves, for the first time in their lives, treading the decks of a real pirate ship as prisoners, and that ship manned by their own countrymen in arms against the flag which had proudly waved from mastheads in every part of the civilized globe. They looked aloft now and saw the rebel emblem flying, when the sailor's heart, which is always open to the tenderest emotions of patriotic ardor, beat high with indignation. at the thoughts, he was compelled to live for the time being under what he called the bastard rag of a bastard Confederacy. I don't often see cuss words. Then he goes on to say, with regard to the treatment which they received during their entire stay on board the Alabama, the officers, without exception, speak in terms of eulogy. Every comfort was provided them, and the strictest attention paid to their every little want. So they didn't like it, but they were happy while they were prisoners. So there goes Raphael Semmes, a good note about him. Next, Rick. On June 11th, 1863, John Elliott went into his stateroom, pulled out a revolver, put it point blank to his head, and pulled a trigger. There in Louisiana, near a bayou, out in the middle of nowhere, they heard his fellow staff officers heard the shot. They ran in. By the time they got there, it was too late. He was gone. They decided that they should bury him, but they couldn't get out of where they were. They couldn't get orders to leave their position. So they thought they would take him inland and try to find a place to bury him, thinking that was the right thing to do because they didn't want to dump him in the bayou. So they landed, found some dry ground, ran into two men. That led them to meet another man. These officers got to talking, the Union officers and the Confederates. They turned out to be Confederate soldiers. And during the course of the conversation, they realized that they're all Masons, which gives you a sense of where this quote's going. They talked some more. At first, the Confederates, who were rather upset because they were being shelled by Hart in his boat, their first reaction was, dump them in the bayou. But the spirit of Masonic brotherhood was stronger than the borders of North and South that separated them. They wound up giving him a proper Masonic burial in the graveyard in a little place called St. Francisville, Louisiana. The folks there started calling it the day the war stopped. They still call it that. And now they celebrate it with a festival. And this image of Hart was recently found. All the folks had been celebrating the festival, I think, since 1999. And they had never seen a picture of him until this year. So there he is. In fact, he writes in a letter to his wife that he hates this picture. So that's not the reason he killed himself. But I guess it's rather unfortunate that this one photograph of him survives. But it does give us a sense of who he was and what he looked like. Next, please. Robert E. Lee was in Pennsylvania. Late June, Gettysburg was about to happen. All eyes in the Union were focused around the Harrisburg, Philadelphia area. While all that was going on, in Portland, Maine, it was June 27th or June 28th of 1863, a ship, towards dusk, slides in to Portland Harbor. All the Maine sailors, they're going about their business, getting ready to turn in for the evening. No one pays the ship any mind. It looks like any other sailing vessel, but it's not. Eugene Brown from, he's a Virginian. He's on board. He's executive officer. Charles Reed is the captain. And they've been on a wild odyssey, capturing, I forget how many ships, 30 or 40, and trading up as they got better ships. So the fishing vessel they had was pretty good, but they wanted the revenue ship that was in Portland Harbor called the Caleb Cushing. And so they plotted to steal the beautiful revenue ship, the Caleb Cushing, right out from under all the people in the harbor in Portland. Eugene Brown, who was a good engineer, but like many engineers, did not really understand the advanced engines that these very modern revenue cruisers had, basically said, "I don't know how to start it." Imagine you get in your car and you're like, maybe there's no key. You're like, I don't know what to do. So they're in trouble. They did the best they could. I think by daybreak, they got about 20 miles outside the harbor. They didn't make it much further than that. The union sent a bunch of local men, got in boats, whatever small contingent of militia were there. They all jumped in boats and they went out and got these guys. Kept them in prison for a while. Brown and everybody else is eventually released. He survives the war and lives a long life. Never really talks about his experience. But the captain, Reed, did talk about it. And this quote comes from the captain. So that's Eugene Brown. Next. Charles Bradford was a Marine, as you can see by his title, the lieutenant. A very bookish, studious guy. Probably preferred a good book to going out and dancing or something like that. He got word that he and his ship were going to be sent to Charleston. This is in 1863. And word was out that they were going to try again to take Fort Sumter. This is coming up on the fall of 1863. And Lieutenant Bradford writes home to his dad and tells him where they're about to go. And his father says, hey, if you survive, or if you're wounded and become a prisoner, however you get into Charleston, I want you to look up a Dr. Mackey when you get there. Dr. Mackey, this is another Masonic story. Dr. Mackey is a Mason. He's a brother. I'm a Mason. If you need any help when you get into Charleston, call Dr. Mackey. Now, his father had never met Dr. Mackey, but Dr. Mackey had written a book about Masonry. So, and they're all brothers, so why not? Look them up. Unfortunately, he did not make it in, well, depending on your viewpoint, he didn't make it in as a victor. He made it in badly wounded. The ships landed on the small rocky area that surrounds the fort. They didn't make it very far. He was shot in the midsection. They found him on the rocks. They carried him into the fort. And he listened to his father. He called for Dr. Mackey. And one of the Confederate soldiers went and got Dr. Mackey. And Dr. Mackey came to the fort and took Lieutenant Bradford to his home and took as good a care as he could. And Dr. Mackey was indeed a practicing doctor, in addition to an author of Masonic texts. One day in early October, Bradford began writing a letter home that his wounds were improving, but then he took a turn for the worse and he didn't make it. Dr. Mackey buried him in his own funeral plot in Magnolia Cemetery in Charleston. A lot of the local townspeople didn't like the idea of a Yankee being buried in a cemetery. They had him exhumed and dumped into Potter's Field. Word got out to the Union High Command, and when they did take Fort Sumter, when Charleston fell, one of the first orders of business for the Navy and the Marines were to get Lieutenant Bradford out of Potter's Field. They took him out, put him in a proper casket, had a funeral parade through town, and they put him back in Magnolia Cemetery. a few years later, as they began to disinter the Union dead and consolidate the bodies in national cemeteries, Bradford and others were taken to Florence, South Carolina, where they're putting together a national cemetery. And that's where I lose track of them. I have notes from Magnolia Cemetery that say the body was taken out of the ground and prepared and ready to ship to Florence. The folks in Florence never received it. So, and he's not buried there as far as we know. So I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm talking to folks in Maine, and I hope by the time the book comes out, we'll have a resolution. But he's still missing in action. Isaac Bradbury tried to get into the army first, and his local regiment, local company, and the regional regiment was all filled up. So he thought, I'll join the Navy. He saw a lot of the war along the coast as part of the blockade. In early February of 1864, he's on a patrol, and somebody sees five Confederates running somewhere inland, and they decide to go get them. So they get in a rowboat, row into land, and chase them down. Here's what Bradbury has to say about it in a letter home. He says, "We crept down until we were about 100 yards when our party rushed out and summoned them to surrender. One of the damned scoundrels answered me with ball and buck. It missed me. And I instantly drawed a bead on him with my Sharp's rifle. And I made a hole in his face as big as an egg. I went up to the corpse, and it was a horrible sight. Oh God, I hope and pray that this awful war will soon come to an end. But I had to do this action for self-defense." This is where it gets hard for him. "There was nothing on him except a rebel newspaper, the Wilmington Journal, and two or three envelopes." He's like a lot of guys. They went inland to try to track soldiers, leading various landing parties. I was surprised at the amount of brutality that these guys experienced. Again, you have this idea that the war is sort of, Navy war is sort of a solitary affair, shooting away on ships. Lieutenant Bradford, Lieutenant or Acting Ensign Bradbury, these guys did some fighting right up front, right on the front lines. Bradbury survives the war, stays a little bit longer. He's down in the Gulf in late 1865 when he's ordered home, looking forward to going home. He also has his first command. And on New Year's Day, as they're going around the tip of Florida, they run into some problems in a storm, and the ship is lost. And they find Bradbury's hat and some of his papers. They don't find his body. And of course, all of his letters survive. So we have some really good insights into him. He did not live, of course, long enough after the war to tell us more, but he's one of the many men who perished on ships in a variety of ways due to weather, due to the bad machinery, and other problems. You often think of the Monitor as being one, but there's a bunch of other ships. So, next. George Work. He really didn't even need to join the Navy. He was 42. He was actually doing pretty good. He was a school teacher, and then he chucked it all and went on to Wall Street. He was making some pretty good money, at least according to his census, his 1860 census. He's doing pretty good. But he eventually decides that he's going to do his part for the country. And in February of 1864, he does the right thing for him. And there's an opening for a paymaster. And since he was on Wall Street, figured might as well stay in the financial game. And he's assigned to one of the best ironclads. It's a monitor class, but it's improved. It's called a Tecumseh. A great ship. Everybody loves it. In fact, they love it so much that Admiral Farragut, who was about to attack Mobile Bay, this is August of 1864, he says, I'm going to wait for the Tecumseh. The Tecumseh's late. And he says, I'm not starting until Tecumseh's here. Well, Tecumseh shows up. Farragut goes into battle. The Tecumseh is right out front. The Confederate Navy and engineers have planted landmines underwater. They called them torpedoes back then. The Tecumseh's out front. It hits a landmine, hits a torpedo, and depending who you ask, it's anywhere from 20 to 30 seconds. That big metal box turns over, goes down. There's a lot of stories about the commander who goes down with the ship, and he has a life preserver on, and he lets the pilot go and says, after you, sir, you know, those kinds of quotes. He wants to save as many men as he can. George Wirt does not make it. He goes down with almost everybody else on the ship. They don't find his remains. And after the Tecumseh goes down, everybody realizes it was a torpedo. Now you know why Farragut is up there on the mast and the rigging, and why he says what is paraphrased today as, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. He didn't really say that. What he actually said depends on who you talk to. But the next guy you're going to meet has his take on it. Does anybody know Henry Howard Brownell? I feel like you should, but we've forgotten about him. Do you know Whittier? Do you know Longfellow? Whitman? Yeah. His name was mentioned. He was right up there. But during the war, they were talking about him. He's like one day saying, this guy is the war poet. He's the battle laureate. Henry Howard Brownell. He was sort of a hack writer, to tell the truth. Before the war, he did a book of poetry. It had some positive reviews, but generally ignored. Did a book, a popular history of the world for children in the 1850s. But by 1861, he hadn't really achieved what he had hoped for. He was in his late 30s. But then he started reading war poetry and political poetry in his local newspaper, the Hartford Evening Press. Every day they'd have a little space reserved for poetry. Nowadays, we don't even really think about that. But back then, words like that were really important. So Brownell starts writing some poems. At first, they're signed anonymous. Occasionally, he puts his initials if he's feeling pretty good about it. One of the poems he wrote is based on Farragut's now forgotten, but back then were famous orders that he wrote before the Battle of New Orleans. Brownell attempted to set the admiral's orders to rhyme, and I'm not sure if he really thought much of it because he signed it anonymous, but he thought enough of it to turn it in, and it was published. Farragut saw it, and apparently it brought tears to his eyes. So he says to Mrs. Farragut, find out who this guy is. So they do a little bit of investigating. They call up the editor of the press, and it turns out to be Brownell. Some communication, some letters are traded, and Farragut ultimately says, you know, just come on, join my staff. You can write poetry. He already has a private secretary, but now he's got a poet. So I like, this is apparently, according to one diary by a surgeon who was on the ship, and this is during those moments after the Tecumseh sank, and while Farragut is up there, you know, the noise is indescribable. In fact, here's what Brownell says. He says, this is just a letter that he writes. This isn't any poetry. He says, the noise being indescribable, the shells and everything, people are screaming, shells are all around. The noise being indescribable and the ship, for all the forward half of her, being an absolute slaughterhouse. Though we only had 25 killed and 28 wounded, it's like an awful lot of guys, over 50 wounded, some of whom afterwards died on that day, yet numbers were torn into fragments. Men with their muscles tense, subjected to violent concussion, seem as brittle as glass, causing the deck and its surroundings to present a most strange spectacle. He writes this later, but at the moment when Farragut is up there yelling, Brownell is down there, completely quiet, completely calm. Imagine him, he's standing on the poop deck. Excuse me. He has his watch in his hand. He's keeping time of what's going on and jotting down notes. And the surgeon says, he's just like up there, completely sober, just calmly standing and jotting down notes like it was a summer day back home in Connecticut. So that letter, or that excerpt I just read you, he writes a long poem called Bay Fight. That's the one that gets him really on the map. And here's that verse that he writes. And he did readings of this. I'm going to slaughter it because he apparently had a really good voice. But here's my version. And now, as we looked ahead, all forward, the long white deck was growing a strange dull red. But soon, as once and again, fore and aft we sped, the firing to guide or check, you could hardly choose but tread on the ghastly human wreck. Dreadful gobbet and shred that a minute ago were men. The poem continues on. I'm not going to read it all. Now, Brownell, this poem I mentioned, Bay Fight, this really puts him on the map. Critics hail it as an amazing piece of battle poetry. The realism that he brings, based on his firsthand observations, no poet had that experience. So he's lifted for a brief time. He's up there. He dies early. Farragut dies in 1871 or 1870. He falls and he gets cancer and dies not all that long after Farragut. And with his death, pretty much dies his reputation. He's quickly forgotten. He crops up now and again in the early 1900s in poetry collections. But today, not remembered. But his poems are pretty good. He's not a hack. I have a couple more for you. Next. Isn't it? Amos Foster was a good guy. He meant well. Really. He was a talented merchant captain. He was really anxious to get into Richmond. Who was it? On April 3rd, after everyone had evacuated, after President Davis had evacuated, Lincoln is on the periphery. He's anxious to get in. Everybody wants to get in. Lincoln is coming up in a boat, the Malvern, with Commander Porter. Porter's starting to get a little bit nervous. He's realizing, I'm taking the President of the United States into a war zone. But they do it anyway because the President wants to go. So the Malvern is steaming up the James River. In front of the Malvern is Foster and his ship. And they're getting caught up. A lot of obstacles, torpedoes in the water are really slowing them down, and also obstacles in the water. the Confederates had sunk ships and thrown in rocks and things like that. So there's one, at one place, Foster's ship gets stuck. And he's got a big paddle wheeler. That's his boat. And he basically says to the pilot, pretty much what you would say if your car got stuck in the snow. Go forward, go back, go forward, go back. Keep doing it, and let's see what happens. So the pilot is cranking the paddle backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And Foster also says, don't worry about the bells, which is the signal. If you hear the bells, you're supposed to stop or listen to them. He says, don't listen to the bells, just keep working the paddle. While all this is going on, the Malvern comes up. Lincoln's impatient, and they get into a rowboat. Lincoln, Porter, and some sailors get into a rowboat, and they try to row through this little narrow opening. And here's the paddle going back and forth. And at one point, Lincoln and the rowboat start drifting into the immense wooden paddle wheel. Foster goes crazy. He's running to the boat. He's yelling at the pilot, stop, stop, stop. In the nick of time, the paddle wheel stops. The president is saved. The president is yelling, which I love the idea of that. This is what Foster, this is his whole quote. He's talking to a group of veterans. He's proud of the fact that he ultimately did become the first ship to get into Richmond. Lincoln got in on a little boat, but he gets in. He's the first one to get in a big boat. And he talks about his experience, and he says, suffice it to say that in the last, I led the fleet up the James River, took out 51 torpedoes so that the fleet could pass in safety, nearly drowned President Lincoln and Admiral Porter, and was the first boat to arrive in Richmond on the surrender of that city. He's a real character. And I got one more for you. This is William Whittle. His father was an admiral in the Union Navy prior to the war, and then he joined the Confederate Navy. Whittle, young Whittle, followed. The elder Whittle was more of an administrator. But young Whittle was quite active. He was all over the place. He was in the East. He was in the West. He was in the Atlantic. He was in the Gulf. He was tapped for special duty to go to Europe to try to... He was basically a messenger carrying notes back and forth from the Confederate government to shipbuilders trying to negotiate contracts in England, trying to get France involved. While he was in Europe, he gets assigned to the Raider Shenandoah. Not his first command. He had other commands. Really talented guy. I mean, he's proved himself over and over again in battle. As I mentioned, trusted as a messenger. Sort of an elite mid-level officer who you probably would never hear about. He and the Shenandoah are way out in the Pacific when bad things are happening, when General Lee is surrendering, when the last holdout army in the West is falling apart, when Jefferson Davis is captured. These guys are out there, and they're up at the Arctic Circle, capturing a bunch of whaling ships from New Bedford. It's great reading. His diary is fascinating. You know, they're looking at these fat Massachusetts guys and, you know, making jokes about them and saying, man, these guys aren't sailors. They haven't lived the life that we live. They've been eating well. They've been drinking well. Let them try this kind of business. At some point, one of these captured whalers, they've got newspapers from San Francisco. And those newspapers contain the bad news. They already had some earlier news from other ships. It was maybe in June and I can't forget, June, maybe even May. They had some word of what was going on. But on August 2nd, 1865, they get the worst news from the San Francisco papers. It's all over. And Willow writes in his diary, "The darkest day of my life. The past is gone for naught. The future is dark as the blackest night. Oh God, protect and comfort as I pray. Oh God, aid us to stand up under this thy visitation." He's mourning a death. "There is no doubting the truth of this news. We now have no country, no flag, no home. We've lost all but our honor and self-respect, and I hope our trust in God Almighty. Were men ever so situated? The captain gave me an order to dismount and strike our battery, turn in all arms except the private arms, and disarm the vessel, as no more depredations, of course, upon the United States shipping would be done." These are the last guys to surrender. And he's the one who basically shuts it down. He takes his commander's orders. The commander also decides that they're probably not going to get a good deal if they go to San Francisco and just turn themselves in, because they're worried, like many guys are at the time. Andrew Johnson is president. Radical Republicans are out there. They have no idea how safe they or their families would be. So they flee to Europe and they turn themselves in Britain, thinking they're going to get a better deal, and they do. The British authorities, I think they spend about 3 days looking over the situation, and they let them go. And they come back home, and they wind up getting pardons. And in Whittle's case, he lives a long life, writes a lot about his experiences, and you get to hear a little bit of that today. So, last frame. I often say that the history of the Civil War is the stories of its soldiers. I've been saying that for a long time. But if you can go to the last slide, and sound. So that's a little glimpse of some sailors. And I hope they will take some time after this gathering to investigate more about the Union and Confederate navies. It's really not an area that a lot of folks know about. I certainly didn't.
Thanks for talking.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.